Log Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. What a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Book Talk with Fran Lewis, brought to you by MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. This is going to be a blockbuster show. For those of you that are out there that think that the world owes you something, that you are entitled to the world, read Face of Greed and find out when you go overboard too much, because the author is here. Good morning, James, and how are you? And welcome to MJ Network. This is going to be great.
I hope so, Fran. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, the first scene in the first chapter I've read 7 times, so I think I have it memorized. How did you create that? Because that really sets the tone, and I have the answers in front of me somewhere.
It really does. The first scene when we open up Face of Greed, Emily Hunter is our main character that we're going to follow through this series, and she's a detective in the Sacramento Police Department. And the very opening scene kind of gives you a little bit of an insight into her life and what she's kind of facing. Even before the investigation unfolds, she goes to her house, and the door is open. It's at night, and we soon learn that, you know, she's been taking care of her mom with dementia, and mom has snuck out of the house. So it's that instant terror that you see when you're a caregiver like our main character is Emily, and it's you know, very unsettling, and that's the first thing that she has to deal with. So it was kind of based on some experiences I had. My mom had dementia, and I was her primary caregiver. We didn't have her living with us, but you always had that fear that, you know, the next phone call, the next issue, the next something coming up, that hammer was always getting ready to drop, and you really couldn't relax, you know, because you had to be, you know, ready to respond if, you know, she wandered off from the memory care facility or it was having issues or had another, you know, episode where she didn't know where she was. So it's kind of one of those things I wanted to kind of give our character, Emily, just a little bit more of an obstacle to overcome as she worked through the story.
Well, I can go and identify with that. My mom was diagnosed in 2003 because I had to retire from teaching early because of it. And I was the caregiver. And she made me sign a paper and get it notarized that I wouldn't put her in a nursing home.
I think, you know, with especially, you know, my mom, you know, her generation, that thing that you just said, you know, you're going to put me in a home, that was kind of a big fear for a lot of people in that age group. It's this, you know, you're throwing me away.
I had to go. I went to about 20 different nursing homes, for real. And after I went to all of them, I said, I really would have to hate you to do this, but you deserve it. What can I say? It cost me. I got Medicaid for her, and the first 12 hours were free. I had to pay for the last 96 every week, $6,000 a month, until I was able to get all of it. So I do understand. And my sister died right before, so she couldn't really help. And my brother had 3 kids in college, so here I am. But you know what? I had 8 home health aides that I picked. If I had to do it again, I'd do it again the same way. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, and that's another reason I wanted to kind of include this theme, you know, in the book, is there's so many of us that are going through that where we have aging parents, and it's not an easy thing to deal with. And so it was kind of interesting to kind of look at that through Emily's eyes as opposed to the way that, you know, it unfolded for me.
Yeah, my mother never used a bad language until she got dementia, Alzheimer's. And she taught me a few words. Oh, God. So how do you decide the major storylines in this book? How did you decide, first of all, Emily is really, you know, she's got a big mouth. I like her. And she doesn't tolerate what the brass said. She doesn't care. And she manages to skirt a lot of stuff, which I think is really cool. So how did you decide in the medicals? And how does she manage to, like, the chief wants her, the captain, she's like, don't worry about it, I'll get there.
Yeah, Emily is, she's a snarky, kind of sarcastic detective, but she's very, very good at her job. And I think because she's so good at it and she delivers those results, she's able to kind of push the barriers a little bit. Emily isn't that unusual in terms of the women in law enforcement that I worked with over my career.
Mm.
She kind of has to be a little abrasive and you know, pushing the limits just to get noticed in a male-dominated profession like law enforcement. I mean, I saw that with women that I worked with who had to work twice as hard to get the same recognition that their male counterparts get. But she's able to kind of navigate that system and push back on the barriers where things are just, you know, giving her artificial obstacles to kind of overcome. But yeah, it's based on some of the experiences I saw that women that I worked with in law enforcement really had to overcome, and I think Emily kind of brings that, and I think she has fun with it in some degree.
So I was lucky, sort of. I had male principals. The first one didn't want me there because the assistant principal was my third grade teacher. She hired me walking down the street. So he put a lot of obstacles, and I pushed him. I was like a big teenager when I started to teach, and I got the worst class in the school, and I proved to him I could do anything. After that, forget it. I found it much easier to work with the guys than it was with a female principal at the end where I decided it just wasn't worth it anymore. It wasn't the kids. So, yeah, it's hard.
You know,
now, the character that I really love.
It's different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Is Javier.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, yeah.
I love this guy. But I felt sorry for him. He's new, and she sort of, like, overrides him. When Emily calls outside the lines, nevertheless, he trusts her, but why? And doesn't he feel like, you know, I'm the guy, I know what I'm doing, so why don't you listen? She doesn't listen to anybody, does she?
She does, but she's got her own compass, and she follows that direction. Now Javier Medina, her partner, he's the junior detective in the pairing, so she's kind of the lead detective. So he follows her direction, you know, in a lot of the instances in the investigation. But he's unique in that, you know, even though he's a man and he has more time behind the badge, he's a junior detective, but he still lets her, you know, assert that lead role. There are some men that would have issue with that, and I think Javier is a little different with that. And Javier brings, you know, a lot of things with him to the job, his background, his mom who desperately wants to see him married and just always matchmaking for him and that kind of thing. So it makes for a good dynamic of two opposing detectives with Emily and Javier.
Well, obviously he doesn't have this male macho problem, because otherwise he probably would say to her, "Yeah, you know, because of who I am." So we're going to talk about his background in just a minute, because I have that in front of me. It's interesting because obviously he's able to temper her, and she just like goes up. But I cracked up laughing when the chief or the captain said, "You need to get here," and she said, "I'll be there in a minute," and comes in 2 hours. That would be me. That would be seriously me, because if I think something's more important than the nonsense that you want, I don't really care. So how would you describe Javier as a person? What's his background? And his mother only wants him to get married.
Right.
Sometimes that's not the right decision, people.
No. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's a unique individual. You know, Javier, you know, going way back, his biological mother abandoned him
at the border when she made a crossing. She was deported, and Javier was left up here alone. So he went into the foster care system, and you know he suffered some the horrors of the foster care system that we hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, luckily for him, he was adopted by a family, and they treated him as their son, and that's who we see with Lucinda, his mother. And yes, she is desperately wanting to see him married and have grandchildren.
Well, as an educator, I work with the foster care system, ACS, and all sorts of agencies. And let me tell you something, exactly what you said does happen. And if you're not on it, if you have foster kids in your class and you're not on it with the foster parent and whatever, really bad things could happen. And you can't be afraid to say something or report it. So, yeah, he was lucky that he got adopted by the right person, because not all kids have that. I do know. It's horrible. I mean, if a child came in one day and said, look what my father did to me, I go, he won't be doing it again because I called the police on the minute.
Yeah, I mean, early in my career, I was a probation officer, a juvenile probation officer, and I dealt with a lot of, kids in the system. And, a good chunk of my caseload were in foster home places. So I'd go around to the foster homes, check on how they were doing, and it was difficult. You had some very, very good foster parents, and then you had some that were clearly just in it for the paycheck. It's difficult to see. And I think as far as Face of Greed and Javier goes, he's one of the lucky ones.
He was one of the lucky ones, because there were so many. Well, even regular parents weren't so great either. And you get nervous because you, as an educator, you're a licensed reporter, and if you don't report it, you get in trouble. So I constantly said, I'd rather have to apologize that I never did. I was always right. That's the scary part. So the book starts out with a home invasion that gone wrong.
Right.
The homeowner has been murdered and widow waiting. So how did you create that? Because that was powerful.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked that. Yeah, it's in Face of Greed, that right after, Emily finds her mother missing and, mom comes wandering in with the caregiver. She wandered off down the street. Emily gets called in on this investigation. All she gets over the phone is it's a home invasion. It's gone horribly wrong. The homeowner's been murdered. The wife has been beaten. And right away she knows this is not going to be her normal investigation, because she gets a heads up that the mayor is already on scene, the chief of police is on scene, so that just heightens this political awareness of the whole incident. So she arrives and starts investigating the case. Now, the home invasion was actually based on one of the first murder cases that I worked on. There was a home invasion, three Aryan Brotherhood gang members, targeted this home because the man was a real estate broker. And they thought because he was a real estate broker, he'd have tons of cash just sitting around in a safe in his house. So they broke in, held the family hostage, and when the real estate broker, the homeowner, couldn't give them the piles of cash that they expected, they shot and killed him in front of the family. So, he died, and they didn't get the cash. The gang members ran out of the house, and it didn't take long to, track them down, arrest them, and get them in custody. And as gang members typically do, they started turning on each other to get the best deal from the prosecution. And they concocted a story that the homeowner, the broker, was some kind of drug dealer, and he owed them money from the drug deal. Like that made, shooting him, okay. But the jury didn't buy it. Nobody bought it. They were all convicted. The shooter actually got the death penalty for the shooting. But that case, that situation, that home invasion stuck with me over the years. And when I went to start writing this book with kind of that home invasion scene, In the back of my mind, it was always, okay, what if something were different in that house? What if that dead man had more secrets than we were led to believe? And what if he really wasn't who he said he was? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we kind of just went, it just kind of unfolded from that point forward.
That was really what got me. I'm saying, wait a minute. He's supposedly whatever, but maybe he's not. And
mm-hmm.
you begin to wonder. So when somebody like him is killed, who takes after? Who takes the role afterwards? And who is his lawyer? Who is her lawyer? The lawyer who took over it? Anderson and Boston. Who are they?
Yeah, you know, you've got, you know, when a situation like that happens, but in Face of Greed, the dead man Roger Townsend was this very politically connected power broker.
Yeah.
And I mean, if there were dirty political secrets in the city, he would know about them. He would have them, and he would, you know, weaponize them and use them. And they were for sale. So, as part of his, you know, business as being a venture capitalist and in control of all these secrets, he amassed a vast empire. So, upon his death, everybody's aware of these secrets out there. And they kind of vie for control over, you know, who's going to let them out and who's going to get damaged by it. So the business that he ran is really concerned about protecting their image, you know, and the company and all that kind of thing. So you've got kind of a circle of people around this crime that, you know, are afraid of what's going to happen next and want control over it. He's a very wealthy, entitled kind of guy and had, you know, a great fortune, and all these people want a piece of it, which means they all had a motive for, you know, what might have happened to the guy. So, you know, his attorney, his business partner, and his wife. I mean, they all
mm-hmm.
circle around this thing that, it kind of makes you wonder, well, who had the most to gain by seeing the man killed?
Well, that's very true. Well, we don't want to say too much about his wife, but
mm-hmm.
she reminds me of an awful lot of people that feel that, you know, well, what the heck, it's mine, I deserve whatever. But she walks around staring at herself in the mirror and thinking that she's the most perfect person in the world. So how does she manage to get around the mayor, the governor, and all the rest of it? I mean, the way you depicted her, I would have figured out she was the most gorgeous person in the world that would have won every single beauty contest, including Miss Universe, maybe.
Yeah.
Her personality is definitely one that I've seen before in other people. That's why I said this book is so cool.
Thank you. Lori Townsend, the widow, we meet her in the opening pages, and over the course of the book, you start to learn a little bit more and more about her. She's, you know, basically Roger Townsend's, I think, third wife, definitely his trophy wife.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she's kind of used that image and her beauty and her sexuality as kind of a weapon to get what she wants in life. And now with him gone, she's wondering, you know, where she fits and how she can, you know, continue to hold the reins of power for what he left behind. But yeah, she's kind of that person that, yeah, I think we all know people like that who kind of use their persona and that kind of thing to get what they want. And I think she's not one of those people that's going to be too shy about, you know, letting you know exactly what she wants and what she's willing to do to get it.
She'll even badmouth you no matter who you are. She doesn't care as long
right.
as it turns out to be in her favor. And when she doesn't get it, you don't want to be there. Trust me. So,
right.
Who is Detective Potter, and what did he have to do? It must have been hard to
yeah.
be the cop on this case.
Yeah, Potter's another detective that Emily comes across in the investigation. What we find out is that the dead man had some kind of a tie with, I mean, these secrets come from everywhere, and you sell them to,
yeah.
to whoever's the highest bidder. But Roger Townsend made a deal with a gang to either hide secrets or get secrets. And Potter is a detective who is involved in the gang side of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Potter and Emily had a relationship early on in their careers. And so, you know, Emily has a little bit of background with him and, you know, experience. But, yeah, Potter, you know, we soon find, you know, isn't exactly, you know, doing what he should be doing on this investigation. It kind of takes a different road.
We want to see what that is. Now, this is, I've read too many books. Seriously. I have. Yeah. It's by now I should be able to process a crime scene in my heart. So when an M.E. like sees Roger Townsend and he's dead, how does he determine the cause of death? I mean, that's always fascinated me because I watch all these lovely programs. And
sure.
I should have gone into something like that instead of I loved what I did. But everybody just processes the scene. So how did this medical examiner process it? And how do you know that sometimes in some of the books, the medical examiner purposely says the wrong thing, and they just didn't give you the right information?
Yeah, it's kind of a fascinating field when you start to dig into it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not my background, so I've had to rely on other folks to kind of make sure I'm saying the right things. But in this case, Roger Townsend, you know, they find him, you know, face down in his study. And he's been shot, and you know he's had his throat slashed. So it's a clear indication that you know something bad happened to Roger Townsend. But the medical examiner is able to find out by evidence in the body that you know he was shot first, and you know he started aspirating you know blood you know in his lungs and that kind of thing.
Mm.
And then his throat was slashed. So there were two distinct acts, and you know she's able to find out which one was first. And the throat slashing was definitely the killing blow, if you will.
That's scary. And yet you don't know who really did it. You don't want to know who did it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you just get a feeling that there's something hidden that nobody knows about. So she gets the mayor and a few other people and the guy that runs the company. She really got around a lot, didn't she? And yet she manages not to, you know, have any kids or anything, but she's just like she just got away with everything just by the way she's speaking. And just listening to her talk in the book, people were afraid to say to her, no. But then
we're talking about Lori Townsend and she wants this investigation over and done with so she can you know take over the business and you know happily ever after and put Roger out of the way and she's you know she can move on with her life. And yeah, I mean we see her trying to move on with her life in various places in the book. You know, she's got Roger's, you know, Porsche that she's out driving around and, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, she's definitely a character that you wouldn't want to cross, but she's got deep down, I think, you know, you're going to find Lori is a very, very insecure person. She's always relied on what she looks like to get what she wants. She's one of those people that aging, she won't do it gracefully. You know, she's going to go fighting and screaming, you know, all the way.
I refuse to do that. What I do is that I just put on a mask and nobody can tell. Seriously. This is my weird sense of humor, what can I say? So Emily and Lori sort of are the same because Lori believes that what she wants and how she wants it done is right. And Emily skirts the capsid and everything. So what happens? What would happen if they went after each other? In other words, if Emily, you know, tries to question Lori and Lori tries to question Emily, it should be interesting because the two of them have this strong personality. Now, Emily is not self-insecure, but Lori uses her like you said, how the way she looks, in order to get anything, because probably behind the intelligence, there's not too much there.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think Lori is probably pretty intelligent, but
in
uses it
way.
To manipulate rather than to try to, you know, build relationships. I think, you know, Emily and Lori Townsend, the widow, probably share some kind of, they're very focused individuals. They know what they want, but how they go about getting them is a little different. I think Lori and, you know, her attorneys and the business, they don't care who's left in the wake behind their, you know, their push. Emily, I think, is probably a little bit more sensitive to that. She might not come off that way, but she's the kind of person that if you're on her team, she has your back, you know, she'll take a bullet for you. But if you're not, if you're on the other side of the equation, you know, she's going to be pretty dogged on taking you down. And I think that's the difference between the two is you know, the compassion that's there.
I know. I don't want to give away too much because I've got the book in front of me. And no one's going to be able to read this because I underline, circle, and cross out. That's how I know what to ask. No, I'm serious. I'm serious. It's terrible. I give my books to my dermatologist, not because I need to see him, but because his wife wants the books.
Great.
And that's how I get the appointment. I'm bringing you books in 2 weeks. Dr. M, you're getting more books. But she'll take this anyway. So tell us more about Lucinda. And how does she really feel about Javier being a police officer? And does she ever get to meet Emily? Because she wants Emily for him.
Yeah, I don't think she wants so much Emily. I think she does meet Emily, and she kind of uses Emily as a go between on her matchmaking efforts. You know, like, why can't you let my son, you know, find a nice girl, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Emily and Lucinda actually have a really good relationship because when Emily's mom's dementia gets so bad that she has to fire a caregiver, she relies on Lucinda to come in and kind of fill the gap. Lucinda used to work in memory care facilities and those kind of things, so she knows how to deal with people. And she's known, you know, Connie, you know, Emily's mom for a long time. So she's able to kind of sit with her and kind of take care of her and does it in a way that's, you know, very compassionate and like as a friend as opposed to a caregiver, you know, kind of just filling a gap. So Emily comes to rely on her quite a bit because, you know, in the middle of this high-pressure investigation, she's dealing with these issues about, you know, her mom and caregiving, and she may have to move her into a memory care facility. And it's she's trying to balance her life here, and it's getting increasingly hard because, I mean, both of these things demand all of her attention. You know, at one point she's thinking, you know, am I going to have to quit my job? Am I going to have to, you know, go on a leave of absence and leave Javier with this high-pressure investigation? And that's when Lucinda kind of steps up and says, you know, I can help and I can take care of, you know, your mom while you and my son go, you know, solve this crime.
I wish I had somebody like that. I was lucky that I used Partners in Care. And Partners in Care, the first two agencies I fired right away, they were crazy. And one aide came in and said, I have a child abuse case tomorrow. They're accusing me of beating my daughter. I said, you could leave right now. I was like, why are you telling me this? Yeah, there are a lot
that.
Of
well,
them.
At least she told you. You got to give
credit. Well, yeah, I fired the agency. But when I got Partners in Care, it was to one of my friends in my school. And I used VNS. They were okay to a point, but I had 8 home health aides. Mm. And because the aide left my mom on the street corner for real, I got the other 12 hours, and I got rid of her. And I had 8 people that were I could, except if there was an emergency to go to the hospital, I knew I didn't have to worry. And the really funny part was that I could leave $1,000, which, of course, they didn't, on my couch. It would still be there.
So you know exactly. So you know exactly the kind of pressure that, that Emily Hunter was under, trying to manage, you know, her mom's care and this high pressure job.
That's why I started this one. In memory of my sister. My sister said I weigh 102 pounds. I weighed 200 pounds because I was eating myself into oblivion. And my sister looked at me, pain in the butt, and she said, "You look like a couch potato." I go, "I hate you." She says, "Why don't you write a book?" And I did. It was about us growing up in the South Bronx. She wanted to kill me because I wrote the truth. and it's like it started out of nowhere. So Javier and Emily, they have like this banter between them. How does she get away with it and he just doesn't say anything? They sort of like, you know, this and that. Like they sort of joke each other, but yet he takes it. And I think he's amazing because most men would tell her to shut up and, you know, I'm here too.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a good relationship. And I think the banter that goes back and forth between it's really fun to write. But it's really reflective of the kind of back and forth that partners have in law enforcement. It's that kind of, you know, teasing, humorous, it's sometimes dark humor kind of stuff that we have in that law enforcement community. And yeah, Javier, you know, takes it and tries to give it back, but he's not quite as, you know, adept at some of the zingers that Emily can come up with. She's pretty good at it.
Well, how do they get, which part does she handle in the case and which part does he handle? I mean, they radio them and I have the book in front of me. There's a sergeant, there's everything.
Right.
I wouldn't go on an escalator because I don't like it. And the TSA employees, how do you deal with them? You have to deal with so many people from different agencies. How do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, you did also.
Yeah. I mean, most agencies that police departments or law enforcement agencies deal with have what they call interagency agreements. So that, you know, a sheriff's department, a police department, if there's an area that's kind of that straddles the borderline, you know, of those boundaries, there's kind of an agreement on who's going to handle what aspects of a case out there. You know, same thing with, it could be any agency, whether it's, you know, out at the airport with, you know, TSA or the sheriff's department of security out there at the airport. You know, there's kind of a protocol on how you let people know what you're doing and where you're at and what the investigation is. In terms of the investigation itself, Emily and Javier have a good working relationship where they're able to handle different aspects of the case and they come together and kind of compare notes and it's just kind of how they work the investigation in the case. They've developed a good working relationship, and it's been effective.
I'm looking at the questions that you have in the back of the book, which won't give away anything. And I really, no, I because I had a whole lot more questions, and I'm saying I better not ask those because whatever. This is very true, because if you see it on television with certain people that think they want to be president, oh my God, Faces of Greed exposes political influence used to control a criminal investigation. Does that happen? Those people that are rich, those people that can pay off the judge or that pay person that says, well, I'm going to get you. How do you deal with that? Because definitely I see it on television every day that people actually think that they can influence the judge and they don't, they really can't. So how do you deal with that? How would Emily deal with that?
Yeah, I mean it's a very real thing, and in Face of Greed, we're faced with it, you know, almost from the very beginning of the book, where the mayor becomes this protective kind of influence over the case and wants it solved very quietly, quickly. Partially because he doesn't want his secrets revealed, but also because he's very fond of the widow, Lori Townsend, and wants to make sure she's protected. So you see that kind of political influence and trying to, you know, squash the investigation and move it in a certain direction. And Emily isn't really going to listen to that. She's going to do what's right. And sometimes that's kind of painful for her, but she's going to take the right course of action. And I think you see you know, examples of that kind of influence being wielded, you know, everywhere, whether it's, you know, city councilmen or you know, mayors or politicians of various ilk. They like that influence and they want to keep it, and they try to wield it sometimes in ways they shouldn't.
And sometimes you think that somebody's on your side and you find out the hard way that they're really on the other side and made a deal. So
this
is true. I have a lot of people, money is whatever. I don't care. Money is the root of all evil. And greed does play a huge role in this story. But there's a lot of other kinds of greed besides money. It's the greed to get attention. It's the greed to get things done your way. Doesn't always have to be money. It's always somebody that feels that, well, I'm better than you are, so just do it my way. And yet Emily deals with the chief and the captain, and they tell her to do it their way, and she gets away with it, which is really good.
Yeah, I mean, she does what the brass expect her to do, but she does it her way.
I agree.
And because she's been so successful, you know, they kind of let her get away with, you know, being a little bit insubordinate, a little bit sarcastic, but she gets the job done, and particularly the chief gets it. I mean, she is one of his best detectives. You know, he's been a line cop for forever. So the chief actually supports her quite a bit. The captain is one of those middle management kind of guys that really has kind of outlived his existence and should retire, and he's just kind of taking up space. And he sees a little chance to get some recognition from, you know, City Hall because he's, you know, inserted himself into this investigation to try to control it. But Emily just kind of works around him to get the case solved.
Well, before I forget, because it's in front of me, staring me, Monday, Michelle Cameron comes on with Babylon, A Jewish Journey. It's really, really, really good. On the 20th, Justin Newland, The Mark of the Salamander. The Mark of the Salamander means fiery, spirit of fire. I looked it up. On the 22nd, this is a first. One of my students wrote a book about her son, who has sickle cell anemia, waking up for school, is called Jamile, and she called me the other day and I go like, really, you remember me? Yep, she did.
Mm.
So she's coming on the 26th, someone we all know and love, David Putnam, Diabolical. And on the 28th, I'm doing something that I've never done before. I've done panels, but this one I'm going to actually be on because I decided that people that have new releases need to stop bragging. So I've got myself, Cindy McDonald, Robert Mazaroff, that wrote The Last Horseman, whose mother won his college education bidding on the horses. It's fantastic. And Mally Baumel Becker, she says she wrote The Paris Mistress, which is really good, about Benjamin Franklin. And don't forget on the 6th of March, Andrea Kane struck dead. I'm like, really? And for those of you that have a new book coming out, you better tell me because April is almost gone and May is practically gone too. I can do June. I'm serious.
Yeah.
It's like this never happened before. It's like, oh, my God. Yeah, somebody emailed me yesterday. I have three authors for you to read the books, but you have to come up with three interviews. And I go like, huh? And, yeah, I'm like so impressed. So before we end, this is a question. This took place in the city, new city. And what did you learn about the city of Sacramento? And did any preconceptions change? Because that's one of the questions in here too. Well, I was going to ask that anyway.
Right. Yeah. This series. Fix Agreed is the first book in a series, and the series takes place in Sacramento. One of the things I'm asked about it, you know, at conferences. I wrote another book in Sacramento, and I was in Toronto at the time, and they were saying, you know, why Sacramento? I mean, it doesn't have the cachet that San Francisco or L.A. or New York have. And it's precisely for that reason. Sacramento's kind of an odd collection of parts. It's a government town, so you've got all the political influences there, you know, heavy influence there. But because of that, you've got people coming in and coming out, you know, of office all the time. So you've got this different populations coming in and coming out. Nobody knows each other. It's a very anonymous downtown kind of area. People just don't acknowledge each other. Ooh. They don't know each other. And because of that, Sacramento has had a very long history with violent crime. And Sacramento has a tie to serial killers that, because of that anonymity and the freeway system and rivers, serial killers have been able to move in and around the city for decades. 15% of the nation's serial killers have a tie to Sacramento.
Mm.
So there's this underbelly there that's kind of, you know, dark and, you know, foreboding, and it's kind of fun to put, an investigation into a place like that, where you've got those political influences to deal with, the crime, we've got a heavy gang influence going on in parts of the city, so it gives Emily a really rich playground to kind of develop her story.
I'm just wondering if anybody is going to do one. Well, we're having the problem up here with immigrants that our mayor, don't ask, and he hasn't done anything. And the governor seems to be on the fringe of somewhere, who knows where. So I'm wondering if anybody's going to write a book or do something about the immigration and stuff like that. I'm getting a lot of books on mental illness and greed and power and stuff like that. That I find. But you wrote, the next book you said is called River of Lies. So where do you see Emily in Javier? And is she going to get a boyfriend? No, seriously.
Yeah. Now, there was a man kind of introduced in Face of Greed, another cop, and she nicknamed him the Booty Bandit because he wore these booties at the crime scene, you know, to preserve evidence. Well, yeah, that officer is Brian Connor, and Officer Connor does come back in the next book to kind of, you know, be a little bit of a boyfriend influence there with Emily. Yeah, River of Lies is the next book, again, in Sacramento. And in River of Lies, the homeless camps are being attacked and burned, and people are being harmed and killed in those attacks. So Emily and Javier investigate those burnings, those arson on the homeless camps, and she soon realizes that even the homeless have something that somebody wants. So it's kind of an interesting investigation on who that.
Everybody has something that somebody wants. That's the scary part, and you have to really be. My grandmother, my step grandmother, even though I know she was my grand grandmother, was very perceptive. And they claim that I got that from her, which is good, because she would look at somebody in the street and say, in Jewish, I don't like them. And I was like, okay. And she just knew that that somebody wasn't right. So if I had a boyfriend, she said, I don't like him, jump him right away. My father was worse, but that's okay. But this book is really, I mean, people really need to think about the fact that the power of money can destroy a family. And I know that from when my sister died, because my sister left everything to my niece and nephew, which is fine. But her husband decided that he was entitled, which he wasn't, and he took $30,000 from each one of them for something called elective share. So this money, he was horrible. Money can really destroy a person if you have too much of it or too little of it. And that's what's scary because, you know, you never know. And that's what's real. That's basic. I mean, the face of greed could be anything, right? And it doesn't even have to be money. It could be the face of power, the face of whatever, or just the face.
Yep. Yeah, I think you see the people in Face of Greed, a lot of it, you know, sure, there's money and there's millions that Roger Townsend had amassed over his career. But those control was a big issue, and power, and who could wield those secrets that Roger left behind. I think that was probably some of the biggest motivating factors behind, you know, all the actors in Face of Grief.
I didn't feel sorry for him. But then she felt she was entitled to all the money too.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't tell what happened. So where can everybody find out about you and your work? And when is the next one coming out? This is an important question.
Yeah, I have two books coming out next year. The next one in the Face of Greed series, in Emily series, comes out, I believe, in December of next year, River of Lies. And I have another series that I'm doing concurrently, and it actually does deal with the immigration issue and border politics and border violence. Dead Drop was the first in that series. Devil Within was last year, and this year Served Cold will be coming out, and it deals with a detective in the Arizona desert between Phoenix and the border in Tucson, and you know his partner was murdered by a coyote bringing over undocumented migrants, so it kind of colored his perception of that issue. He finds a series of bodies in the desert. They're all undocumented migrants, but they are connected to the man who killed his partner. So he follows that trail across the border, gets trapped down south on the other side of the border, and actually needs the undocumented population to help get him back home safely. So it changes his perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's publishing that one?
That series is published by Level Best.
Oh, I know them. I've written a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, they've got a lot of good stuff coming out of there. And then Face of Greed River of Lies is through Ocean View Publishing.
I love Ocean View because I don't ask for anything; mm-hmm. they automatically send it. That's how I got your book.
They're great. They're great.
Because
yeah,
Face
great.
Loves me.
Yeah.
Best level books I know. I work for Partners in Crime for free.
Yeah.
They send me the people that want reviews, and then they send me the books for free. I never know what I'm getting. So Gina and Wendy are great, and I have to say that they have given me this week, because of my wonderful, they said, a book blast.
Yeah.
Yes. So I have a book blast that started on Monday. It ends tomorrow. And all I wanted was showcases, interviews, and spotlight. And somebody wrote a review, and I said, I never write negative anything, ever. If a book isn't worth 3.5-4 stars, I'll just write a summary. And she wrote a review, and at the end she wrote something that was really not very nice. And I did answer the other people involved, because I don't critique something. And she said that my book was not edited properly because there was no consistency in characters, but they were all dead. And all the stories were different. And everyone was different. And I had it edited by some New York Times authors read it first before I had it published.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch. And I just said, you know what? Whatever. You can't worry about it. But so
no.
And where can we find out level and best level books? And the toys are really, I mean, she's fantastic, Gina. As a matter of fact, she did an Instagram on my book yesterday that I crafted with. I couldn't believe it. It was really nice because she felt bad about that. So where can everybody get all of your books? And when am I getting another one?
You can find – folks can find me at my website at jameslatwell.com. Or I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at James Latwell or author James Latwell, depending on which one you're looking for. You can sign up for the newsletter. I do a newsletter that deals with, prison to the page kind of thing. So, you know, little snippets about prison facts and that kind of thing. But, Level Best Books and Ocean View, you can both, you know, contact through there. The books are available, you know, wherever books are sold, whether it's Amazon or your independent local bookstore.
Well, I have to tell you, I put your review, I have it, I'm going to send it to you. I put your review on LinkedIn yesterday, and in 5 minutes, there were 25 views. Everybody's reading my stuff on LinkedIn. It's like, are you kidding? One of the authors that's going to be on the panel show got 598 views, and you're coming close. Yeah, they're reading it, and I'm like, oh, my God. And then they're asking me if I want to pay for a premium, whatever, not really. And then one person said, I can promote your book. I said, no, that's okay. And another one said, you know, you're great for an MBA program. I said, I have 4 master's degrees and a PD. What do I need another one? I mean, seriously, did you read my profile? But thank you so much. This has brightened my day, seriously.
And thank you.
I can't wait to get the next one. And I hope Best Level Book sends me it. And if it's coming out next year or this year, just let me know because, like I said, my schedule's filling up, everybody.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Bye now.